Today's show is going to give you an amazing reason to be optimistic as an American. Our guest today, Johnny Dang, is one of the original Lost Boys of Sudan. He tells a harrowing story that you'll hear here today as part of our program. But he also talks about what it was like to become an American and to become part of our culture, leaving something that was much more primitive and that was much more dangerous. Now, if you like what it is that we're going to be talking about today, you just go ahead and press that subscribe button. Let's get on with this show. Johnny, I'd like to welcome you to the Optimistic American.
Thank you for having me.
All right, you have an amazing story, and you're definitely an inspiration to lots of different people. But what I'd like to do is I want to go back to your childhood and start there. I want to start by talking about the village that you came from in Sudan, what it was like.
Yeah, you know, thank you for that. You know, people always ask me, I always said that my childhood was stolen, you know, before I become, you know, because I was in at such a young age when all of these civil war broke out. So as I remember, 5 or 6 year old, so I remember we were just normal, we never starved. We go after cattle. We were the cowboys before I find out when I came to America, there's the cowboys here.
We're we think we're the original at everything. Cowboys in Africa for thousands of years.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So because our society is set up by animal, which is cows and goats and sheep and you name it. We were ranchers, so very much the cowboys. So as a young boy, as a 5 year old, my job is to go herd the cattle. That was it. I didn't get to go to school. I didn't get to do anything. So I remember we just play outside the village sometime as a normal life. We have food. Things was good. We go fishing because we have a Nile River. So it was a normal it could get. I don't realize there was another world outside of my village. That's how I remember.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, and by the way, tell me a little bit about the village itself. Did it have electricity, running water? Did you have new appliances? I mean, what was the lifestyle like?
The lifestyle was very much, it would be like almost like Stone Age. There's no running water, no light. I didn't get to see my first light or running electric thing until I come to different country, which was in Kenya. We were just remotely, literally running with nothing. Yeah, we get the water to drink from the river. We don't even have a candle to light. Mm-hmm. So literally, there were no modern civilization stuff until I get to move out of there.
All right. So, tell me about the event. How did you lose your home?
Well, so this is what happened. So the war. Just a little bit of background of Sudan, for those who don't know, you know, the geography a lot of the time in Africa or Sudan in general. So Sudan was colonized by British and Egyptian to begin with. Well, way before that, we were, and people didn't know these. So Sudan was Kutch, the Kutch Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Before all of this stuff, people only talk about Egyptian today, but this is way go back. So,
meaning in Sudan, there were people who built pyramids.
There you go. Before the Egyptians started.
Right.
That's exactly right. A lot of people don't know this because they only know like later on. Mm-hmm. So we were the Kutch Kingdom, Merik tribe, just roaming around, right? So, and then later on become the Nubian from the Nubian king, which is a lot of people know that. So literally, Sudan, I always said, we're going back all the way to the Bible. So we were part of all of that. And then until like later on, Sudan, the name didn't come until like later on. Within all that time, the Egyptian, the Arab from the north, of the north of us, we started coming in. Now you get the British. You get influential from the other, you know, the countries. And then that's when a lot of the problem began, leading into all of this unrest.
So let me pull this apart just for a second.
Yes.
So to help people geographically, you're just to the south of Egypt.
Correct.
Right? And you're just to the west of Ethiopia.
Correct.
All right.
You got
so
it.
So you're in the northern portion
northern
of Africa.
Northern portion. And then we also, you know, you get the Kenya and Central Africa, Uganda, and Congo, all the way down. Yeah.
Right. So now, Sudan ends up There's a northern portion and a southern portion. Southern
part, correct.
And there's like a swampland.
You got it. And southern part where I was born is swamp.
Oh, okay.
Correct.
All right. And the northern portion, even before the British and Egyptians took over, ended up becoming part of an Arabic.
You got it. They took over a lot of that time because they were the one where they settled in.
Right.
First.
And so it was controlled mainly by Muslims.
By Muslim
religion. And then
exactly.
The southern portion was controlled mainly by Christians.
And
Catholics.
They believe in their own goddess. Yeah, exactly. Right. Which is our tribe. And which is my tribe.
So
yeah.
To begin with, that was one of the separations.
Correct.
That existed. And then the second thing that began to happen is that the northern portion early on gained control over the government. And when they gained control of the government, they basically starved the resources from the south.
You got it.
And kept most of those in the north. The Mayan.
And that's, you are right on what I was going to say. That's okay. Exactly right. So you know, you did your homework very well.
Well, our audience hasn't, so feel free to go yeah. back over that.
So that's what happened. So in 1956, the Sudan got independent from British.
Mm-hmm.
They finally, the British finally left. Well, as soon as they leave, they left unrest right then. Because now you get the Arabs, you get the Southern, which is our, they would believe in their own goddess.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've been a marginalized, the Southern being a marginalized, and the resources were on the south. Most of the resources, oil,
mm-hmm.
and this is what creating
so
all
the oil's
problems.
Down in the southern
that's
portion,
right.
But it's being basically being the money
tech,
from it.
There you go.
Is being taken
to,
for the
to
north.
To enrich these, right. Guys, and that's what's causing the civil war.
Mm-hmm.
The civil war started in 1910. So it started then, it lingering until 1972. There was a peace agreement with the side. They linger a little bit, and then the next leader took over again, and literally forcing the Sharia law. Which was the president after the first president of Sudan at that time, which was Nyerere. And then you get the guy we just they hosted not too long ago, he been there since 1989. So he forced everybody, if you are not a Muslim at that time, Sharia law, you might well just cut your heads off. So that literally it was a nutshell. So now the southern people, like people are, I was born into, they started, we cannot do that. We got to fight back. And that's how the Civil War began.
Okay. So I'm going to go, before we come back to talking a little bit more about your village, I want to set just a little bit more up. So this event, the United States gets involved in a number of cases, but one of the places we get involved is a little later. We had Osama bin Laden, who ended up being actually protected by the more radical Muslim groups that were in the northern component.
In Khartoum.
Right.
Yep.
And so what that did is that obviously pulled the United States more into it. And at some point in time, we saw some peace a couple of times, but then the peace would break apart. And I think we're at war even still today in Sudan. Is that correct?
Still. It just gets started even more now. So here now, going back to my village. So now, because of all of this, so the war was going out through the region. So the war didn't get into my village. I didn't know what was going on in another part of the country because, you know, I was just in my village until 1986. And that's when the soldier and the rebel, at that time they were calling the people who were standing up, rebel, the government was calling them that. That's when the fighting started in my village. It finally touched my village. And that's when we finally running for basically in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on the northern component, I believe, well, I know that even in the 18th century, the northern portion was coming down, the Muslims, and they were enslaving people.
Yes.
There's a word for that. What is it that they call the southern people?
They call them the Nilotics, but there was a different word.
But it was a way to objectify them.
Yes, justify. So they can do whatever they do.
It's a word similar to the word that we wouldn't want to say here in the United States. It's a very derogatory word.
Yeah.
And so for years they were trying to pull them up and enslave them and then sell them into slavery.
Right.
But so there was already some animosity built up between the two people.
Already.
It was already there. Mm-hmm. And at some point the people from the South realized, hey, we have to get organized.
That's right.
We have to begin to create militaries.
And that's exactly what happened. And that's what caused. So the first, we call it, there's a word in the term for this revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Nyanya 1, Nyanya 2. So you get the Nyanya 1, started all this. So they were in the 70s and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Nyanya 2 in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
in the 1983 to be exact,
mm-hmm.
which is led by John Garang. That was the leader of that, and that's what the plan. We have to organize and have an army because this is it's going to continue. Mm-hmm. We're going to merge a lot. Yeah.
But at this time, you're five.
Right. Okay. Five, six, whatever it was. And all then right. one day, we were in my village in Joko. We were out herd the cattle. The first thing we saw, there were a lot of boom song noise. And we're like, what's going on? The next thing you know, building, I was building my hot homes, being the burn to the, we see in the fire. And then we were like, well, if we go back, that's dangerous. So we need to start, leave the cows and just start walking. We don't know where we were going. That's when.
So how did they end up, I mean, you end up with these 20,000 boys that are right. marching across into
throughout
Ethiopia.
Across Sudan.
What happened to their parents, their family members, other people? Why are they by themselves?
So a little before that, so there were recruitment was going on at the child soldier. Mm-hmm. A little bit in the villages by our rebel groups, mm-hmm. which is our military, we mm-hmm. called them, you know, at that time. They were doing a little bit of recruitment. We can bring you, we get you ready for the next stage, for the next generation to fight. Mm-hmm. So that was part of that. But part of it, it kind of got everybody up guard to the point that every mom and a dad, they're like, no, run, because you're the generation. If I get killed, at least you go to tell what happened. And that's what happened for many of these thousands of children leaving.
All right, and so you end up on this march.
Yeah, I ended up in the march. I joined the march later on. I didn't know at that time, actually, the march started way before, like 5 years before that. Mm-hmm. So more and more kids were going already to Ethiopia. So at that time, for my time, we didn't know, because I was right on the border of Ethiopia. If you, my village is like literally, like really not, I would say maybe it takes maybe like five, you know, now it takes 15 hours for a car. Mm-hmm. Back then, there was nothing. So it probably would take 2 days. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, to go to Ethiopian border, to cross the border. So we have to, that's what we decided, we have to walk. And now we met other kids along the way. And then now people are showing where to go and where not to go. And where, that's, mm-hmm. yeah.
All right, so tell me about the walk. What was it like?
Well, the first walk in Ethiopia, it was very, because here you are against, there's no food. Sometimes we have to, because we have to avoid, many, the bad guys were on the where they know they can catch people at. So we avoid that. So we were walking through desert, mountain, you name it.
You're avoiding the pass
avoid
and the roadways.
Correct. So it probably, like, it took me probably like almost a month when we should have get there, maybe like a week or so, because we tried to avoid to finally get to the safety. It was really horrible. We lost a lot of some of the kids.
My understanding, the trail was lined with young
right,
boys
exactly,
that
waiting
died.
For you. Yeah, you can imagine. It's snagged by lion, hyena, you name it. Mm-hmm. Every
starvation.
It's starvation. Mm-hmm. The week, so you couldn't walk anymore because when you eat, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of that happened, a lot of tragic, and you just have to keep marching.
So you have 5, 6, 7, 8, yep. 9, 10-year-olds advising one another how to get to safety.
That's right. But in mind, we were, and I always say this, we were it. You were, if you are 10, so the 10-year-old was advising or helping or caring for the 5-year-old and the 3-year-old and the 4-year-old. Mm-hmm. So we were it. We were the family.
Hmm. And so you end up in Ethiopia.
Correct.
So what's it like when you get to Ethiopia?
So we get to the camp in Ethiopia. So the camp was not really, when you talk about refugees camp, and the food was not really there. You get some little tents. It's not like a camping tents when we go here to go camping.
Yeah.
So it's literally, you have no clothes on you. They give you one blanket, one cup of a maize or a rice or whatever it is, and a sugar or a salt, and then you wait for 30 days. That was the life at that time.
And fortunately at the time, the Ethiopian government had opened up so that you could come in.
Correct, right. That was wonderful mm-hmm. at first. But meanwhile, we did not realize while we're coming all in and you're thinking we get to safety and blah, blah, blah. Ethiopian government themselves, they were having a civil war in the northern Ethiopia was going on. And we didn't know what was going on also. But our rebel group was training with it in Ethiopia. So they were welcoming also to train for military training with the Ethiopian government. So now moving forward, the year go on, the year of 1991. So now I get there in like 86, 87, right? So we stay there for maybe a few years or so, or 3 years. In 1991, they overtopping the government of Ethiopia.
And now you have to leave.
Now we have to leave. And that's the walk, another walk we have to go do.
How long did this walk take?
So that walk, 3 months.
3 months?
Yep. So now we have to go to South Sudan, back to where we came 4 years before or 3 years before. Now we have to walk to the place all the way to Kenya. And now that's another a long walk. It's just that itself and so, with the challenging.
So when did you start to know you were going to have to leave Ethiopia?
So it was, so they kind of warning. And literally we don't have to leave, but the Rome, you know, sometimes the human will get Roman. It's not, you know, it's not what they say it is. Mm-hmm. And everybody was preparing, but they didn't know what day and what exactly, but they know they were preparing. The new government are coming in because it's friend with our rebel military group. They're not going to want us to be here. Roma just get out of that like that, which is not true at that time. Mm-hmm. We could have been fine, but everybody anxious to really, one day, one morning, everybody started running, and that was it.
Literally running?
Literally running. You just grabbing whatever you can, and you just have to follow because you cannot be left behind. People are running, there's something that's happening.
Gotcha. Yeah, so you know there's danger on the other side, yes. And you know your friends are going that way. That's
you
enough to know to run.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so you go through this three-month journey. Tell me about that journey.
Yeah, so the journey we have to cross the river, that was really with a lot of crocodile, a lot of kids was eaten, and some of the kids...
Kids were eaten?
Couldn't swim either. More than any, maybe alligator and crocodile on these rivers, it was more than some of the kids do not know. Half of the kids was wiped out because they did not know how to swim, because some of these kids or boys at that time was not from the villages that were near the water. So they didn't know how to swim. Myself, I was nearby the water. I was nearby the river. But the river going through Ethiopia, through South Sudan. It's a little stream, they were called, not the big river. But so we spent a lot of in my young life learning how to survive, getting fish. So a lot of people was wiped out, a lot of the kids, because of not know how to swim.
Did you lose any friends?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I lost a lot of them that mm-hmm. who were... In the camp, we were together, and unfortunately, you cannot do anything. You got to run for your life. It's sad.
So at this point, there's no plan. There's just surviving.
Survival of fittest, when you talk about human surviving. Mm-hmm. That was it. You have to go on your own to survive, and other person, you go, okay, so just keep marching, whatever we have to do. Mm-hmm. And walking through desert for 3 months, no food, sometimes no water. When we run into river, we drink a little bit, and sometimes also the Khartoum government. Yes, that a lot of diseases cholera. On the way, you name it, because you're drinking these are territory water. And also, there were a lot of helicopter. The government was chasing, because now they know we are moving out of Ethiopia.
And they don't want you.
They don't, so they were bombing. Chasing, also bombing.
Wait a minute. Who's bombing who?
The Northern Sudan government.
Is bombing the kids?
Bombing our the kids, yeah. Because they know we were in the military. We were all part of the military camps. And now they want to do the job to make sure we're not going to come back to go fight them. And that was the chase. So there were a lot of chases. What's going on?
All right. So you go to Kenya.
So I get in Kenya in 1992. In Antarctica, familiar, we finally get there. And this region is all the way to northern Kenya, is the place, territory is so desert, there's nothing there. There's one tribe there, the Kenyan tribe, it's called Turkana. They really aren't welcoming. Mm-hmm. So now you get the UN, the US, the Red Cross, the other agencies try to convince them, we will help these people. They tell the Kenyan government, we will buy the land, lease the land, so let these people come in. It was terrible. We have stand off for a week. They don't want us to be in their region. We just, here you have stranger people coming into your home. Like, who are these people? What are we going to, you know? Mm-hmm. So you could, at that time, like, why are they not letting us in? But, you know, at that time, later on, we understand why. This is their home. Just like, if somebody come to my home, I'm like, right? Mm-hmm. If some like everything is happening here too, right? Immigration
problem.
And conflict. There you go.
Yeah, very complex. Right? But not if you're the 5-year-old or the 12-year-old.
Yeah, they didn't care at that
time.
Trying
to figure out how to be safe.
Yeah, but they don't care at that time. Yeah. That was not their concern.
All right. So how do you end up in the United States?
So meanwhile, I was in this area. They finally get us to get in the camps, and we settled in. So meanwhile, at this time, 5 years now went by, or 6 years, if I remember, I didn't hear anything from any other family member if they're alive or not. So here, one day, my brother was walking in with another group, and here he is running, walking into the, into the Kenya camp where I was in. He stayed there for almost a week. We didn't know because it was a massive of people. And one day we were getting water. We went to the water station, which is, they were pumping water kind of thing. And here he was, getting water, I'm getting water. And we run into each other. And we just checking on ourselves. Wow, we just give a big hug. You survived. And I survived. Like, that's, we were like celebrating.
Yeah.
But we didn't know where the rest of the people were. So at that time, the Red Cross and the UN starting to get resettlement talk about resettlement. Some of these people, either Europe, America, Canada, Australia, you name it. At that time, the talk was already happening, because part of the problem, I know you alluded into that really here, is that here you get massive, these young teenager boys, particularly a lot of them. There were some girls, but mostly the majority are boys. At the camp we were in, they also, that's when the war on terror begins already. By that time, there's a lot of lingering what's happening with today terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Back then, they were not that known by that name, but they were already starting recruiting in the camps. So now the US and the other Western world decided, if these kids, boys, get a hold of by the bad terrorist group, we in big trouble. Now it's gonna get out of hand. What about we start taking some for a resettlement agency? And that's how, in my case, and my brother, they have to give you application, you have to apply, whatever the country is. At that time it was US. So we deploy a lot of US State Department to interview people with the partner up with the UN, with the United Nations. So the UN have to do referral to whatever the country is. And then they're like, okay, these people are the priority. And that's how we started.
Did you know how to write?
No. Everything was translated. I didn't speak a word of English. So do my brother. No English for both of us. He thinks he's speaking English at that time, but it was like, you know.
Yeah.
We literally, everything was translated. We have to say in our own languages, and they have to record it.
Wow. Okay. So... So do you even know what the United States is at that point?
I didn't even know what even the name, there's United States of America. I have no idea.
Right.
I know about Europe, but I didn't know anything about,
So we take about, out of that 20,000, we take about 3,000 into the United States.
Well, not only just that. Before that, there were other family came. Okay. So probably United States, by that time, before the boys, before all of us started, so-called the Lost Boys today, before all of that, we already took in about 22,000 refugees from Sudan.
Okay.
And then 3,000 follow after we get here, and then now there's more kids was coming. So the U.S. was one of the, when the Lost Boys resettlement started, it was one of the one time in a large group than any U.S. never done in our immigration history.
So you fly from Kenya to the United States?
Right. So
what city?
Yeah. So you have to go through interview. You have to go through all of this. So you find out now you're in the camp. Now they bring you with a bus. Many of us never been a bus or the bike. So getting in the bus in modern civilization, everybody was just like, get sick on the bus with the gas. And this, people were, even though we were so through it, after you finally gone through a year of interview, interrogations, and you name it. So it's not you just coming over the border. This is you have to go through a lot to even get. And some people, to be honest with you, their case, their file is missing. So until now, they didn't even have to make it. So I was one of the lucky ones, me and my brother and a few others. So we finally get to from the camp, it's about 12 hours. From camp to the Nairobi, which is the city in Kenya. So the Nairobi, Kenya. So we finally get there. They set us, they put us in this big hotel. We have the light and running water and all this. We're like, wow, this is wonderful. Because many of us seeing the phone for the first time, you know, those phones you have to do back in the 90s, you know, you have to dial a ring. Yeah. We're like, wow, this is so. So like many of us are young, you know, we were just like in tune with those. That was our first technology. And then we finally now, we finally, they have our flight ready. Oh boy, I remember that was a lot scary because now we are onto a territory that we unknown, we don't know at all. So they're like, you get a flight at this time, at this time. So they get us to the airport. So we flew from Nairobi, from Kenya airport, from Nairobi airport. We have to go somewhere in Europe. I think in our case, if I remember this correctly, I think we went to Belgium first because it's about 10 hours there. Usually Kenya, Uganda, they use those route a lot. So we went there, and then after that, we ended up coming from Belgium to JFK, JFK to Phoenix.
And so you, what time, how old are you when you end up in Phoenix?
Probably by that, by this time, I would like, technically, we, that's another story. Many of us do not know our age. It's a made up age. You know, you know, Aryan probably researched this, you know. So technically, they put me, I was 16 by that time.
Okay.
And my brother was 18.
All right, so you come to the United States, you come to Phoenix. Yep. Tell me about that, what was that like?
You know, I didn't know anything about Phoenix, about Phoenix, Arizona, right? So they remember when they, so what they do, they post, where are you going? And they're like, oh, where are you going? You're like, I'm going to Phoenix. We call it Phoenix at that time. We didn't know the name for it. We're like, where did that at? We're like, we don't know geography, where it is, it's west, east in the United States. So we get to New York, they're like, yeah, you're going to Phoenix. And it's all the way the west end, it's all the way in the west end. We are, you are right now in the airport in the East Coast. It's all the way the west end, and it's hot, and it's desert. People were thinking, I'm like, well, that sound like familiar with what I came from, because we were in the hot and desert, you know?
Yeah.
So we finally arrive here. We find, I remember we arrive around 1 a.m. in the morning, and my caseworker was in ready in hand, waiting for us, because all the volunteers always wait. My caseworker, Dana, and then my foster mom, Mary, that's, she's become, like, later on, my mom that I had to go home with. And then we arrived, they all show up in the airport waiting for us with a big welcome sign. Welcome to Arizona, you know? So, in the United States. So it was very, like, wonderful. At this time, we didn't speak a word of English with them. We just, somebody, there was a translator they brought that would know our language, who already been here before. He was Sudanese also, he came here. So, and we're like, okay, well, good to meet you guys. So now we have to separate you, because your brother have to go, because he was quote unquote 18. He have to go with other boys to go live with them. And you, because I was underage, you have to go with Mary. And I remember the first thing they did, so now we get in the car, the first thing they look at me in the back there, in this Sudan, they're driving, and they're like, you know, you can tell that they were talking, I think I haven't eaten, because the airplane food was different. I didn't eat in the airplane for all 24 hours, because this is a long flight.
Yeah,
I didn't eat. I was like literally like getting sick, because the food was not familiar.
Yeah,
you name it. We have so many stories when we came down here for all that, just food alone.
It was rich compared to what you were
used to. There you go, exactly. Yeah. So the first thing was hoping at 1 a.m. in the morning, it was Jack in the Box. So they took me in the drive-through, and they all, you know, they order. And my first technology, I mean, in a radio and talking, I'm like, the, you know, the microphone, and they're talking in the order. I'm just sitting there. I'm like, wow, this is a wonderful technology they have here. And now we're the food, because now I'm watching, you know, like what's going to happen next, you know? And that was my first thing. I'm like, wow, this is wonderful. So they order the food. I'm like, wow. So how they know they talk over there, now they give them the food here. So that was my first.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, so you become a U.S. citizen?
Right. So now they had to put me, so now I'm 16, no language. That summer, my foster mom, Mary, decided, you know, what are we going to do? They cannot put me in a high school yet. They cannot put me in a community college. They cannot put me in a in a good school because, you know, I'd be behind. So they put me in this language school, which is still up today in Dunlap here. It's called Elizabeth School at that time. So they put me with the language so I can learn the language. Because you remember, I didn't get to go any first grade, second grade. I didn't know any ABC. So I had to learn a little bit. And then the fall come, now they're like, oh, we're going to register him in high school. Now, 9th grade in high school. And I'm like, what? What am I going to go do? How it's going to be? This is going to be very interesting. So here, the first day in the class, Coach Garcia. So I ended up going, they registered me at Shadow Mountain High School, which is up north here.
Uh-huh.
So that was the very first. I was the first color boys in there. I mean, literally, that's, things were so new over there.
Yeah.
So now they have to register me, and they have to put me in high school. I'm like, oh, boy. So I remember in the back of my mind, I'm like, this is not going to, how am I going to even start to write? I didn't even know how to write my own name. So the first day with the PE, Coach Garcia, he's already recruiting me from the day that I walk in there. He go, So he was the cross country and track and field coach at Charamon. So he go, I think we just got, I can just tell what was going through his mind. I think we just got ourselves the fastest Kenyan runner that he never seen. I think we just got better. Our team just got better. So you recruit, so he said from now on, and with the translator at that time, from now on, I want you to just come and change with your PE coach, the clothes, and then go run 3 miles. Hear this man telling me running. And I remember, I'm like, this man, I have no idea. I've been running for all my life, and now he's letting me to run again. I don't need to run anymore. I run enough already for my life. So that was one of the stories that I get to tell a lot, and you know, high school adjustment to the, you know, to the language and stuff. But he saw something that I didn't see, and then I become one of the best states of Arizona runner. Like in 3.5 years, I graduated high school, so I get in scholarship to run for PPCC, the, you know, Paradise Valley Community College, and then went on to ASU.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't get to run at ASU because at that time things was just like there was a lot of things was happening. Meanwhile, I was in high school and try to fit in, my brother was struggling with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the reason why I always share this is that when you see these many people, it's wonderful you in the right, you know, you think you're in safe area, but you're just starting another war because now you gotta deal with these immigrants, like our military coming back from overseas. That was just, in our case, it was that. And many of us today are dealing with that with a lot of problems. So my brother ended up at that time, this was right 2 years after we arrived, while I was just trying to catching on, running in high school, doing the best I can, try to fit in as a teenager, he was having struggling a lot in a really stage of post-traumatic stress disorder. So he went to the people who were sponsored, because when you come here, you have a sponsorship. So at that time, the agency we were a sponsor has here locally in Arizona with Catholic Charity. So one day, and their office used to be on 19th Avenue and Northern. One day, my brother, I didn't know until this day where he got this again prom. So he walked into that building. He was crying for his help because that's all he knew. He was a child soldier when he was little, crying out for help that I need help. But at that time, it was not a lot of resources. A lot of people did not know these refugees was coming into our community the way we could done a little bit different. So thank God he didn't get to, but he went to scare everybody in the building. So they called the police. This man with a gun in the building, and they told him to put the gun down, and he didn't want to do that. They shot him and killed him instantly in the office there. And the reason why that I always share this, because that's part of our story. We come here, we think we're safe. Everybody, all refugees who are coming now to our community, either Iraqis or Ukraine, whatever, you think you're here, you went through so much. And the war just, again, it's begin because now if you don't know how to done with that or you don't have the resources for that, now you end up having a lot of, struggling a lot. A lot of our number, I always say we have a wonderful, successful rate, so-called the Lost Boys of Sudan. 85% of us ended up either have a high school diploma, a college degree, or a higher today. But you have about 25 to 30% of that are not doing very well because of PTSD.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you formed this organization, the Lost Boys Center. Why? Why did you do that?
That was the reason why. After my brother's death, me and other group, we don't want the same thing to happen. So we form it. First thing was education. Second thing, they have a safe haven to come in. So my brother, we form it after my brother's death. And that's what was my passion. And this is the reason why. So I have a place for them to fellowship. They can share their culture there. Now they're in a different, now they're in the new world. Now they need support with those, and many of them, and this is how, why we found the Lost Boys Center.
All right, so the, I'm interested in the perceptions that you began to form in looking back on that, and advice that you can give to people. First, do you have gratitude for being able to come to the United States?
Absolutely, yes. That was a blessing, and I thanks to American taxpayer, American people every day for giving me a second life, mm-hmm. because I would not know what my life will be. Mm-hmm. I always said this, I was the lucky one to mm-hmm. be here among other who made it here, because there were so many of them were not lucky. Mm-hmm. So I thanks American community for that.
So other kids that you were going to college with and that you were spending time in high school with, I can't imagine that you didn't confront people who sometimes had a sense of entitlement or sometimes didn't have gratitude for where they were. Did you find that sometimes they rubbed off on you, or were you always trying to rub off on them,
It's funny. I do have some of those friends, actually, and I have to remind them where I came from. But at that time, I didn't know how to tell my story uh-huh. to them. But I told them I just came from the war, and then you're complaining about that your mom didn't make your sandwich the right way. So, or my car, because some of them driving, you know, they were 16, 17, and some are complaining. Oh, my mom didn't give me the gas money to go. Like, dude, you can walk. I walked 1,000 miles. So, yes, sometime I remember I tried it. And I had to be, you know, not too hard, because everybody, I always said we all have story. So some of the kids also, people have story, even though they were born with everything here. Mm-hmm. There's story. There's things happen in life, and I always try to keep that in mind. Everyone have story, but other they're severe or they can complain than other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. You know. So Catholic services played a role in helping acclimate you. Mm-hmm. My guess is that means that they saw a connection. They saw a connection probably because there were a number of kids in the Southern Sudan that were Christian who were coming here.
It's not so much, it was not about religions. Mm-hmm. They were just the work they were doing with the federal government. Okay. Because actually, they were hoping to all of their dogs, because they were helping everybody, not only just the Christianity, mm-hmm. The Christian refugees. They actually was, they were kids, mm-hmm. were coming from other part, like Somalia. They are Islamic. Mm-hmm. There's more. So they were, because part of the grant that they were getting from federal government, you cannot, as a law, as our constitution, we had to treat everybody. It doesn't matter what their background, religions, whatever. Mm-hmm. So at that time, they were, it wasn't that connection. It was just connection to help someone who need help. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The United States, why is it special, you think? What makes us different?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I always think, sometimes, as much as I like to say, we all the same heaven to try to help other a lot of time. We always in the front line, but also we have to be careful on how we put our nose into what. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? If mm-hmm. it makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the American people are very special as a part of the human right, mm-hmm. Stefko. Mm-hmm. We feel bad, mm-hmm. right? So, mm-hmm. you know, when there's something going on, we always said, it's another human being, you know, kind of thing. Even though there are some people,
there's a great deal of compassion.
And I think part of that, imagine we have our own issues. There's no perfect world, you know. You know, there are some good people out there in this community. And that's what has always overshadowed the bad people. Because of that compassion, I think that's why we always, U.S. is going to be always number one in the world because of the compassion that the other nation, they do it in a small scale, but not how we, you know, we come on to do it, if it makes sense.
And when you were going to ASU, what were the classes that you took? What did you study?
So I studied social work. So I, because I decided somebody give me a hand before I want to get back to the community.
Okay.
And that's what I've been doing since then. That's my job. So serving at the Lord Boys Center, and then also I was a medical social worker at St. Joseph Hospital, so with the Dignity Health. So now I am I'm a life coach for this wonderful intellectual disability who are these people are from our communities, and now I'm mentoring them with a life skill, how to become a better human so they can get back despite all the challenges, which is, we, them and I, we have we have a story to tell. They have a challenge here, I have a challenge in Sudan, and we talk about that. So I'm trying to them overcoming their challenging so they can get back to our society, so they can be a good citizen instead of people leveling them. They have a disability.
When you're giving advice as a mentor, what's the main advice that you're giving people?
So the main advice is that it doesn't matter what challenge you have, you can overcome it. We can overcome it. If I can do it, you can do it.
That there's a sense of agency.
There you go. That's right. And that's usually, that's what I always try to give the advice. If any, here you get a child of war that who came here with naked body to United States, never speak a word of English, came, he go on to college, he have his own business, he's helping running a nonprofit. If you can do it, you can do it. And I have an 11-year-old, I tell her the same thing. She's complaining about homework sometimes. I say, you can do it.
You have an 11-year-old, huh?
Yes.
Does she know your story yet?
Yes, she get to, oh yeah. And actually, part of that, I get to, sometimes when I go to speak, so I go to speak with, so because we have a box now, we have a lot of movies. So one of the movies is called The Good Life by Reese Witherspoon. If those people, if you want to go watch it, it's wonderful education. It's based on our, and I consult on the movies. So, and we have a lot of books. So time to time, the high school or seventh grader and these other school around the nation, they will read some of our books and they call us to come speak to the class, either through Zoom or in person. And I sometimes if it's here, I text my daughter with me. And sometimes she come and Google me because I did TED Talks and all this. She come and Google me on YouTube.
So have you been back to Sudan?
Yes, so we go once a year. We just recently, the Lord Boys Center, because this has been our goal for a long time, one of our program in South Sudan, now we give them back even in South Sudan to our community over there with education. We just opened up a biggest education center last June. So we were there and we cut the ribbons. And now we just graduating our first group over there. These women who've been in dying of war trauma. They do counseling there for them, PTSD. And then also we put classes with sewing machine classes. And we just graduate our first group. And now we're getting the next group over there. So I go once a year.
You know, it's funny, the these microloans, there are companies that go out and do these microloans, and I've lent money or given money to the Micro Lending Institute. And in, I think it was in Thailand, I went up into the mountains. They had given just a loom to a group of villagers. They had nothing else, but we bought them this $300 loom. Now, amazingly enough, we got paid back with interest, which I didn't really want the money back, but
no,
that's part of
it. But that's the principle. That's part of the business.
That's right. Key to them. In fact, I love this woman who was in this bank. She was a Swedish woman who had gone on to becoming an NGO inside of places throughout Southeast Asia, trying to help poor people. And then she finally ended up going to Kenya. That's where she finally ended up.
Yeah, to Africa, yeah.
Yeah, and she created this microloan industry. And she created it because there was a ghetto. The NGO was failing. It just wasn't accomplishing what they wanted it to do.
It's always fail.
Yeah.
Including Bill Clinton, he admitted himself. We come here, we think we can change the world, even including the Clinton Foundation. we fail these people.
Yeah.
That's why.
So yeah. she says, yeah. As she's packing up, this woman came to her and said, hey, I'd like to go. I think I could get this fresh produce from these farmers and I could take it into the ghetto and I could sell it to these people in the ghetto. And she says, would you lend me the money? And she says, well, how much money do you need? And she says, $5. So she goes, okay. So she lends her $5, keeps packing up. Day later, lady comes back and says, hey, that worked really well. I want to pay the $5 back. Here's my interest. She goes, wow. But she says, I think I could do this again for like $10 because I sold out everything I had. So she lent her some more money. This lady, the Swedish lady, built a billion-dollar bank that gives microloans. Her average size loan at $1 billion is $60 a loan.
Are you kidding me? I need her number. Yeah. We need that for our group.
Amazing. So anyway, so I'm ready to give them money. I brought some other Americans. We're all ready to give money. And she scolded us. She said, why is it that you Americans think you can just come into a country and give people money and they're going to be okay? She said, look, your people, they forged their way across the United States. They went through incredible hardships and sicknesses and everything else. She says, but they got a little piece of land or they built a little business. It built grit inside of them. Now, of course, what she didn't say is along the way, we had this thing called the Constitution that were protecting individual rights along
over
the way
there,
and property rights. That doesn't exist there. But her point was, no, I won't take any money from you. But if you want to lend some money, I'll let you lend it. So in any event, I lend this money for this loom, right? A year later, I get my money back. Wow. And so, but they wanted another loom. So I said, sure, but I want to go see it. So I drive
up. Which is a good idea.
Yeah.
To go you visiting.
So I drove as far as we could drive up into the Golden Triangle where this place was. And then I had to hike for 2 days to get to the
That's
village.
That's all about right.
So, and when I got there, they had this loom. The entire village was making cloth, everybody. And then they would take the cloth down to the town and sell it. And it was enough money that people could live. And
I think about that.
It was stunning to me, right? Which is why they wanted a second loom, because they were making money. They wanted to make more money, right? Yeah. But I think it's easy as Americans to not really understand what it's going to take to fix a problem. And
that's
we think if we just give a check,
that's
going to do it.
And your point being is, well, this is what's going. So, for example, one country next to us here, Haiti, what we did, what is going on right now? See?
Yeah.
It's not been working because we've been pouring every time the Asian have an earthquake, every time the government is turmoil. There's a national disaster, of course, which is my heart go out. But we go in, we think we can just fix it. Just pour them in. There was one example about, there's a documentation called the Poverty Inc., including Clint. It's foundation, all the foundation. That's exactly what this lady was telling you.
Yeah.
She's proud of in there, saying you just think you're going to fix the problem. This is not, you don't know what the problem you're going to fix.
In fact, we met with the leader of Rwanda, who was a Tutsi, and he at the time was cutting off all NGOs. He said, you're not helping us.
Yeah.
You're smothering
You're giving them actually a poor mentality thinking.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Because these people, to be honest with you, everyone, especially right now we're working in our center in Juba. South Sudan.
Okay.
Because, South Sudan become independent in 2011. For those who, I know we talk about the story of a war, but eventually South Sudan becoming their own independent country now. So in Juba, South Sudan, there are these women, they're wonderful. They know exactly what they need to do. And the one thing they told us, if you can provide us with sewing machine, that's all we need. We will figure out from that. And we loaned them those sewing machine. And now they're graduating. Some of them already graduate, earning money. Sewing, they go sell them to their community. Now they're sewing them. Now two of the lady already, they came back. They let their family run the business. And now they're coming to teach other class, newcoming class. So to your point, yes, we very compassionate. We just go, we want it. No, these people, this is not what they want. They want to work, bring something that can be.
And why do you think that's so different? Why is it so much more beneficial to give them a sewing machine to work than it is to just give them cash. What's going on with that?
Yes. So for many people in the world, when you grow up, and in this case in South Sudan, maybe it's a different case from these lady that you're helping, you know. So all they know for this time, all their life, is war, running away, running away. They never really get opportunity. And many of them were born into the war. They never real opportunity to have their own lecture thing. They can so proud, wake up in the morning, I want to go do. Human being need something they look forward to, right? Mm-hmm. That's our dream. If you wake up in the next day, every day you're just sitting sad, you're not looking forward for anything, that's the trigger right there. And that's why it's always, because they're not just looking for hands. They want to show you, you know, they want to show them, I could do that, but I just don't have enough opportunity to do it.
You know, I think it's true in the U.S. also, Bill Clinton, who I loved my time with Bill Clinton. He was always fun to listen to, but he loves to tell this story about the big hurricane, Katrina. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Anyway,
Katrina.
There we go. I don't know why I couldn't come up with that name, but he said that when the Katrina hurricane took place, that he raised a bunch of money and George Bush helped him raise it. George Bush was a Republican, older George Bush.
And they worked together,
And they worked together. So anyway, he comes back, he goes, okay, I'm trying to figure out how to spend this money. Should I go do schools or should we just create a charity to give money out? Should we give away food? What should we do? And he said that George Bush Sr. said, well, you know, you raised the money and you're running it. He goes, I'll let you figure out how to do it.
That's your job.
And so Bill Clinton says to him, okay, but how would you do it? He goes, oh, well, if it were me, he said, most of those people lost their fishing boats. Go help them replace their fishing boats.
That's it.
Give them a loan to replace their fishing boats so they can start fishing again. They can pay it back. And in the meantime, they're going to employ other people. And Bill Clinton said,
wow.
You know,
genius idea.
Right.
And that's exactly
it. Overwhelmingly, you have to engage the human spirit. And
Absolutely.
The human spirit isn't engaged by gifts. It's engaged by having a sense of mission, a sense of purpose, something that is bigger than us, something that's mine that I'm working towards.
And it might be the principle of it, but that's go a long way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the principle of looking forward. Well, I got to get, but no. The people, and I hear this over and over a lot when I go back, you know, we just have nowhere to start. Mm-hmm. I just want something to start something with.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they're asking.
Mm-hmm.
And we, one of the time we did a village, we went over it with an Ethiopia border right by my whole village. So I went back, we raised money. We met with everybody, what is that you need, including all the elder who left behind. They never run. They run and then they went back. They run and went back, right? They don't want to go anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
This is their world. This is what they know inside out of this forest, this mountain, whatever. So they told us, they're like, what we need? Fishing hook, fishing net, axe to chop down some of the, so they can build. They can have a, what do you call it, to cultivate their land with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all. They're like, we don't need this money. We just need, just bring those. And we're not going to ask you again. And that's.
Yeah, that's an old
think
saying.
About that.
Don't give them the fish.
That's why, right?
Like teach the them Chinese how to fish.
Saying, there you go.
Yeah. All right. So what's your goal? What are you gonna spend your life doing now?
So I think my goal when I'm retired, I'm still working. My goal is what you said really here. My goal, I want to have enough finance and start a loaning company to the people, to help people, to thrive.
That's awesome.
This is my goal. And I wish the lady that maybe you can give me that contact, that lady, I got to sit down and talk with her because I have a lot of ideas.
She is a beautiful lady. And I have to tell you, like, gray hair and she was
she just wrinkled
from the sun
and
crusty.
She just go in.
But she bit right into me one. And she goes, why is it that you Americans think that you just
and
give away money
her.
And fix this problem?
I will get along with her very well because that's my, yes, I want to help and get back to the community.
All right.
For more than life.
If somebody wants to take part in your group, how would they get in touch with
you? So you go to our website. So
we'll put that up on the screen.
So the website on the screen right now. So it's lbcld.org. So it's right on its screen. They can get us our email there, our telephone number is there, everything.
All right. And so if they supported you financially, what would you do with the money?
So the right now, we will get more sewing machine in Juba, South Sudan for this woman.
More sewing machine.
More sewing machine. We have a 100 waiting list as we speak. Waiting list.
Wow.
Everybody in our door begging every day. When can I have open? We want to open more classes.
Yeah. And I would encourage people, if they gave money for that sewing machine, to do what they can do to go see that sewing machine at work,
because
it changes everything.
And I always welcome everybody to come to South Sudan. Uh-huh. Please come with us, contact us. We can sit down. We'll take you to the center, meet all this lady. We just did a wonderful program that these ladies, really quickly, that this they are based on Christian-based church organization uh-huh. here in Pan Hill. It's called the Lady of Hope.
Uh-huh.
And these ladies,
I know them well.
They retire. And they get together and they sewing. They just donated like $1,000 for the sewing machine for the lady in Juba. And we put them with a Zoom call. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
From Juba to here, it was wonderful.
Okay, I want to be one of your guests next time you go to Sudan.
Please come. Yeah,
I consider that to be a genocide site.
Yeah.
Because I think that was a genocide. And I've been to most of the other.
And it's keep going right now too.
Yeah, and I learned so much every time I went to one. I've been to Cambodia, Rwanda.
Oh, wow.
I went to Bosnia. It's amazing how, you know, I mean, certainly it helps you feel gratitude, but it also, when you start to watch the human spirit and how people are able to keep going.
They
and
can even lift up from that. There you go.
It, in itself, it's inspirational.
And that's why. And then by going, you actually get to talk to them face to face. You see their face. And that's what I always try to tell people. Don't just give things. It's wonderful, but also you should invest by coming.
Yeah.
See what's going on like you did. To go.
By the way, I love that word. Invest. I've had to learn that with my boys as they're growing up. They'll probably hear this and get mad at me. But I learned if I gave it to them, it destroyed them and me.
Yeah.
But investing in them, what is it that you're trying to do? Do I agree with that or do I not agree with that? If it's not the right plan, no, I'm not going to give you any money.
Absolutely.
But if it's the right plan, that's an investment that I think we're going to see.
There you go.
An advantage.
Bring me the proposal.
Yeah, uh-huh, that's right. Hey, thank you so much, Jenny.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Wonderful.
I want to go on your next trip.
Yeah, please come.
All right.
This June. Are you be ready?
This June?
In June.
I might have to do the next June. I'm going to the Prime Minister of Australia came here and they invited me to go to Australia.
Oh, you're going to have to go to that. So the next one then.
I'll do the next one.
Okay.
This is Paul Johnson. Thanks so much for being a part of this show. If you like what it is that you saw, press that subscribe button, become part of our community. Our whole goal is to try and help renew the American spirit. And Jenny, you did a great job of that today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.